Good afternoon. It's Saturday, February 14th, 2009. I'm Harley Schlanger. I will be your host today. In his most recent webcast, delivered on February 11th, Lyndon LaRouche gave an example, a personal example, of the quality of leadership required for these dangerous times. His presentation, which is archived on LaRouchePAC.com, provided the new Obama administration both the background to the present existential crisis and the programmatic solution required to solve it. The Obama administration is now facing serious decisions in the weeks ahead. The financial crisis was not solved by the Geithner plan, nor by the stimulus package. In fact, the financial crisis is worsening dramatically and will continue to do so until the president adopts Lyndon LaRouche's proposal for placing the whole banking system in the bankruptcy reorganization, while initiating a massive investment of government credit in high-end technologies for infrastructure, such as high-speed rail and nuclear power plants. The day after LaRouche's webcast, February 12th, was the 200th birthday of Abraham Lincoln, who, along with George Washington and Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is on the short list of great presidents. President Obama, who, like Lincoln, is from Illinois, has expressed his great admiration for Lincoln. But how much does he really know about Abraham Lincoln, who saved the United States from an all-out offensive by the British Empire to destroy our national sovereignty by breaking up the Union? On today's program, we will provide President Barack Obama, and of course, all our listeners, with the essential background on why President Lincoln was successful. What did he know about the great enemy of our nation, the Anglo-Dutch Empire, that President Obama needs to know today to successfully steer our nation from otherwise certain destruction? Our panel today consists of three people who have done extensive research on Lincoln. I'll be joined by Anton Chaitkin, historian from Leesburg, Virginia, Phil Rubenstein from Los Angeles, and LaRouche Youth Movement leader Michelle Lerner from Washington, D.C. So I'd like to welcome all of you to the program.
Hi, Harry.
Hello.
So I'd like to begin with a synopsis from each of you of your thoughts on why Abraham Lincoln is justly considered one of our greatest, if not the greatest, president. Tony, why don't we begin with you?
When Lincoln was president in July 1861, he asked Congress to appropriate an unimaginably large amount of money to save the Union for military spending and to put the equivalent of what would today be 5 million troops into the field. He said, "This is essentially a people's contest. On the side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men." This idea that the United States had a mission to physically improve the world and to radically change and upgrade the conditions of our citizens stemmed in Lincoln's mind from his own adoption as a young man in Illinois of the passion for improvement that he saw in the United States government back in the 1820s. And this came, I think, the image you should have in your mind is Franklin with his electrical experiments, his spreading of the idea from America that science and the conquest of nature could be used to transform man's condition. Lincoln already in Illinois built railroads and canals, spectacularly changed the setup of the country with the starting of Chicago and so forth before he ever came into the White House. Lincoln knew, as one of, I would say, a handful of Americans throughout our history, deeply the nature of the enemy as an imperial European-based oligarchy and their system extended from Europe into our country, coexisting against and at the same time we had our system with our Constitution in the form of slavery, in the form of usury, in New York and so forth, and that system, international colonial system, had to be overcome with its degrading of man into backwardness. There, just to give you the best picture to sum this up, in the London Economist last week, they had a cover showing a fist or a hand coming up out of the grave, and it was labeled economic nationalism. And it was their specter haunting the world. They're hoping in London, in the city of London, that what Lincoln stood for, what he did to surprise everybody as president and take a broken union and a free trade period and turn it into a massive, massive industrialization for the USA and the world, making an irreversible change with steel mills and electricity as the outcome. The world can never go back behind what Lincoln did with government measures to forcibly industrialize. They say, we've got to stop that. We can't let that ever come back. Our job, of course, is to bring it back now.
Okay, that's very interesting and useful starting point. Phil, what do you have to add to that in terms of the question of Lincoln's greatness?
Well, I mean, it would be an addition to what Tony said. I think that there's a level, and I think this goes to what you have to see in someone like Lincoln. Lincoln understood his own role, his own mission, in a profound sense, in terms of a kind of ongoing polemic with the population, with the citizenry. You know, it's often commented the level of literacy of the Union soldier in many of these letters, and I think the thing to understand is that much of the population was elevated to that level by Lincoln himself. I mean, he saw himself as a young man as representing the founding fathers, or the actual fight for the republic. There's the famous Lyceum speech, which is often denigrated by historians as being, you know, high-flown rhetoric and so forth. But he states there that, you know, the spirit of the revolution, of the American Revolution, is dissipating, and we stand to lose the republic. Now, this is about 1837. It's around the time of the Andrew Jackson shutting down of the National Bank and so on and so forth. So he understood himself to be in the tradition of the founding fathers, the American Revolution, creating a new republic. And he ends many of his speeches saying, for all nations, not just for the United States. He was a protege in many respects of John Quincy Adams, who also saw this. I think Lincoln saw very early on that the nation may not survive. And by 1854 and the Kansas-Nebraska Act, he, in effect, did something like what LaRouche is doing today. He forecast that the nation would not survive the onslaught by the British Empire to divide the nation. A house divided cannot stand. And at that point, he re-entered politics after being out for a while when there might have been some other idea of solving the problem. He re-entered politics. He was part of the formation of the Republican Party. And he determined that if necessary, he himself would save the republic as comprehended by the founding fathers, by John Quincy Adams. He acted on that, I think, for the entirety of the rest of his life, knowing that he was, as he said in Philadelphia on the way to the inauguration, that he could be assassinated. So he decided that every element of his knowledge, and I think this is highly underestimated, he was a great thinker. He was a Platonic thinker. You know, that was his view of the nation state. Without the nation state, nothing else exists. The republic, as developed in the Constitution. And he stood on the essential principle of all men are created equal as the necessary principle to activate, to reunite the nation, and to ultimately win the Civil War should it come. And he oriented everything from that standpoint. I think he, at the same time, was able to communicate this idea in his speeches and public letters. Mm-hmm. And I think nothing hits, I think, as hard as the second inaugural, because he basically says that there is a power greater than one's individual feelings or one's individual position. And he even calls upon the Union to recognize its own failings, the North, in conceding the American system in the period leading into the Civil War,
right.
going for free trade, giving up the national bank, et cetera, et cetera. And so he basically says, in order for you to rebuild this nation, and I think the Civil War is really the continuation of the American Revolution. The solving of the problem of slavery was essential to the existence of the nation, to breaking from free trade and so forth. So that he stood as as you might say, upon the shoulders of others. He was a deep philosophical thinker. He was capable of facing the future effectively alone, if necessary, and the fate of the nation, and leading the nation to deal with that future, to overcome the obstacles. And he had no problem disputing with his own supporters, polemicizing with them, as he did in many of his public letters. And I think that he used humor and irony in a profound sense to do that. And so I think one of the things to understand is this was not a practical politician with some ambitions, mm-hmm. but a deep philosophical thinker who elevated public discourse to the level of drama and poetry.
All right. And Michelle, I think there's probably still a few things that can be said after those two. So in your view, how have you come to appreciate the significance and greatness of Abraham Lincoln?
Well, Phil had already brought up the speech that Lincoln made, this Lyceum speech, quite early on. And in that speech, the way he approaches the issue that he's raising there is from the standpoint that you had an entire generation of individuals that were themselves involved in fighting in the revolution, the American Revolution, which he was pretty much surrounded by this generation, and as it was dying out, that he was worried that the biggest threat to the United States was that the idea would actually tend to die out with them. So what he posed was that it's not so much of a military threat or that type of a threat that stands as a threat to the nation, but it's really the threat of the population not understanding what the principles were that fueled the fight of the American Revolution. And the interesting thing, and you see this throughout his entire life, that despite all the pressure from various angles that he was getting, he had a very clear idea of the principles, and that any type of action he would take would not compromise those principles that the Constitution was based upon at all. You see this reflected in the way that he dealt with the question of slavery, that he passionately wanted to end slavery, but he didn't want to do it in a way that was unlawful or unnatural to the process of the development and evolution of the nation. So what he always put in the fore of his mind was these principles and the way that the principles act throughout history, despite all the pressure that was put on him to act in the moment, you could say. He really had an idea of a long-term process, even into the future. And I just wanted to add that the interesting thing the other day was when the 200th I guess you could call it a celebration at Ford's Theater, which is kind of a funny place to have a celebration of some birthday on the spot they were assassinated. But this is it for the reopening of Ford's Theater. But I would really hope that being in that place at the time that we're living in today with the type of danger that exists today, I really hope that President Obama had a tingle in his spine, because that clearly the fact that somebody had to go to the extent of actually assassinating Lincoln because of how powerful he was, it really goes to show what type of opposition there is to really carrying out what Lincoln was carrying out and the legacy that he represents, which is what needs to be carried out today.
Well, Michelle, while we were speaking, I'm glad you brought up the event the other night, because it was clear to me that you've been in Washington, D.C. now, what, 2 years or something like that? Maybe a little longer?
Pretty long, I don't know.
But clearly what you were talking about in terms of the principles and the rekindling of the spirit of the revolution, we saw this pathetic spectacle of the so-called debate on the stimulus package, and it's clear that you're reflecting the great gulf between what Lincoln represented and what we have in the Washington, D.C. today. Do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, I think the biggest problem is that we live in a time where people don't really appreciate the process of history. I don't think they fully understand it. First of all, as I mentioned earlier, Lincoln was growing up amongst a number of individuals, a generation of people that fought the American Revolution. And you see, his life extended through that, continuously from that period through the Civil War. And then right after that, you had Franklin Roosevelt actually living in a period where you still had the presence of the memory of a fight of the Civil War. That was something that was part of his boyhood. That was something that people had a real grasp of. People were there. They remembered it. And he, Roosevelt, led us up through the fight in World War II, which the United States played a decisive role in. And we're at a point today where, see, this continuity is there, and it's really not that, thinking about all of the varying events that have happened throughout all of history, that's a very short period of time with very clear continuity that really is on the verge today, just reflected in the way that people think about economics. This economic system that we've had right now is really about 30, 40 years old. And if you actually do a study, it takes about that long for an economic policy, if it's carried out, to actually die. If it's a bad economic policy, you have these cycles. And it's actually been throughout the history of the United States a real fight over economic policies where there really isn't anything that is immortal about the policy that we have right now, and people act as though there was. I mean, I've actually started to notice that, as if it was in direct response to Lyndon LaRouche, that a number of people have been making mentions, like Barney Frank on the radio the other day made mention to, well, we can't just start over from scratch. And not just him, but a number of people have been making these kinds of references where they know the thing is falling apart, but they can't conceive of actually going back to an idea of a principle again and starting from that standpoint, which is exactly what had to be done every step of the way to make progress. It is what Lincoln did. He had to introduce the principles, the economic principles again with his presidency to reverse the decadence that we had gone through in the period leading up to that. So it's without a real understanding of the process of history that we've gone through as a nation, it's a real challenge to get people to see what possibilities and what potentials actually do exist.
Well, I want to take that up, this question of economics. I want to tell our listeners, remind them they're listening to The LaRouche Show. This is February 14th, 2009. A special program on Lincoln at 200, what President Obama needs to know about our 16th president. If you have some questions, you can email them to us. Our panel will take them up. It's radio@larouchepub.com. That's our email address, radio@larouchepub.com. Please feel free to send questions. If they're not exactly on the topic, we'll probably pass them off to people to answer via email response. But, Tony, let me go to you now, because Michelle brought this question up, I think, quite well.
Yes.
The parallel, what you had mentioned, the fear among the British of the resurgence of economic nationalism. What was it that Lincoln did that completely overturned the pre-Civil War geometry and created the potential for a change in the world?
Well, he reintroduced the Hamilton economics and transformed the country with high tariffs, government credits, the Transcontinental Railroad, and a number of other measures coordinated. But I want to introduce that by going back to the other time before 1861 when Lincoln traveled to Washington to assume office. This was in 1847 when he had been elected to Congress. It was in the middle of the Mexican War, and he understood precisely that the policy of free trade, of leaving the economic power in the hands of an international cheap labor system, such as plantation slavery or today's globalism, is a crime and would obliterate our country. And this is imperialism. So on the way to Washington, he stopped off in Kentucky and went to hear a speech by Henry Clay about the evils of the Mexican War. When he got to Congress, as people probably know, he introduced a measure to embarrass the sitting president, Polk, over having lied to get us in the war. And Lincoln wrote later, when he was running for president, that the actual cause and purpose of the Mexican War, the U.S. invasion by the slave owner-dominated government, had been to cover up the giveaway of half of the American territory on the West Coast, what is now British Columbia, to the British Empire. That was the reason that the war was carried out. That, in other words, the government of the United States was in that time acting as a stooge for the British. When he was in Kentucky and on his way to Washington in 1847, Lincoln internally speculated and wrote a series of notes about international trade. These notes they're called Fragments on Trade, I think, and you'll see them in his collected works, in which he went through the entire case for imposing restrictions with protective tariffs to stop cheap British imports and to build a United States steel industry that would give us actual independence. And his arguments were very, very powerful, including the idea that to make a distinction between productive and non-productive labor. It isn't any good just to put somebody to work you could pay somebody to carry a load around and around the outside of his house for 8 hours. But that's not productive work. Some of our boomers need to understand that distinction. So this idea of economic nationalism, that the founders, the real founders, Washington, Franklin, Hamilton, had, that was revived by Lincoln, was on the basis of Lincoln. He was chosen as a protectionist at the Republican Convention. There was a big fight in 1860. They knew what he had in his mind. So when he became president, 2 days before he was inaugurated, in fact, March 2nd, 1861, the Congress went ahead and put through the Morrill Tariff, which raised the taxes on imported steel in particular and other things. Lincoln put through other measures to raise these to absolutely prohibitive levels so that our steel industry began because Lincoln was president. He passed through the measures to have the government pay to build two transcontinental railroads, the Union Pacific and then later the Northern Pacific. He started the agriculture department and put scientists throughout the country in every county to help the farmers. He started all the state colleges and on and on. But the idea was to see, first to grasp this truth that our nation, with its elected government, had to be using its full array of powers to concentrate the credit and resources of society to bring about the progress of our citizens as a fight against a mortal enemy that for the last 250 years or so has been located in London and with a colony in Wall Street. He understood that completely. He understood the nature of imperial wars as well. So this is something that Franklin Roosevelt certainly picked up. His father was actually employed by Lincoln's friends in Philadelphia for a while in the 1870s. And this idea of what the purpose of our country and our government is, this nationalist idea where we respect and love other people's nationalism also, this is has to come back now or we're threatened with the same evils that the fascism that threatened us with FDR and the breakup of our country that threatened us with Lincoln. We have to do this again.
Well, this is an important point given that the direction of the country for the last 30 years has been against national economic sovereignty and national sovereignty, so-called globalization. Now, Phil, I'd like you to pick up another one of these broad themes that come up around Lincoln, which I think Michelle alluded to earlier, which was the question of slavery, because the detractors of Lincoln, and there are many, from the Howard Zinn types at Boston University to the reparations crowd, their argument is that Lincoln really was not against slavery, that was a secondary issue or a tactical question. What does the evidence show us on Lincoln, and how does this relate to what Tony and Michelle were just talking about on economic nationalism?
Well, I think the record on this is the record of lying is incredible. I mean, I think the most extreme one that I heard is that he had slaves. this is just not true. I mean, there's no factual basis for it. There's no historic record of it. But it's just stated and slandered. But I think more substantially, you have two things. One is everything in the record, going back to when he was in his mid-20s, and he introduced into the Illinois state legislature when he was part of what was called the Long Nine from Sangamon County, with a guy named, I think his name was Stone. He introduced a resolution on the question of slavery in Washington, D.C., Now, a lot of people have said, well, you know, this was just a posture. The truth of the matter was, as witnessed John Quincy Adams' efforts on this issue of slavery in Washington, D.C., this was the point of attack on slavery, in part because it was a symbol, since it was the capital of the United States and it was virtually a slave town. But number two, it was within the Constitution, and Michelle raised this point. The only way to attack slavery within the Constitution was to first go at it on the Washington, D.C. question, and then use that as leverage to the question of the morality of slavery in the country as a whole. So, and this was the point. John Quincy Adams, every year for, I don't know, 10 years, I think it was, introduced various bills to lift slavery in Washington, which is where the Congress had sway, had legal control of the situation. And, of course, every year, the Confederate faction, led by Calhoun, would insist that this they would table it. It couldn't even come up for discussion. So the issue of slavery in Washington, D.C., was the core debate over slavery in this period of the 1830s and the 1840s. Now, there's nothing in anything Lincoln ever said that condoned slavery. He was absolutely opposed to it. He thought it was hideous in the Lincoln-Douglas debates. He references this over and over again. Now, the issue that comes up, I think there's two issues that come up. One, he answers absolutely clearly in the letter to Greeley, after Greeley in August of 62 attacks him for not freeing the slaves. The abolitionist line, of course, Greeley was a funny character in this, but Lincoln understood that much of the abolitionist line was an effort to destroy the nation by saying, let the South go, and implicitly, because the plan was to spread slavery throughout the West, let the whole of the continental boundaries of what would become the United States be divided up. So the abolitionist said, I will keep my hands clean by disassociating from the South. And much of this was run by the British. One of the more interesting elements of this was Frederick Douglass, who broke with the abolitionists over the question of the validity of the Constitution. And what Lincoln answered to Greeley in a public letter was, if we don't have a union, we have slavery. If the Republic of the United States does not survive, then you're conceding slavery not only in the South, not only in the western portions of territories of the United States, but everywhere in the world, the Caribbean, South and Central America. So Lincoln stood firmly and with a great deal of intellectual courage on that question.
Right.
And when he found the moment to liberate the slaves under the conditions he could, because remember, people have said, well, it was just the military. It was just the states that didn't come into the Union. That was where Lincoln had legal constitutional sway. Lincoln was the commander in chief. That was the point at which he could, by executive action, free slaves. And that was exactly the way he approached it. And it was an impenetrable argument. But it wasn't just an impenetrable argument. It was a statement of a moral stand at the same time.
That's how that's how the slaves were freed by the army.
Yeah.
Well, this gets to one of the next points I wanted to pick up, which is how it is that we see a country such as ours, which has been saved on several occasions by this kind of leadership. I think the founding fathers gave one example of that. Lincoln certainly as a virtually solitary individual. I mean, he had allies, but Lincoln stood head and shoulders above the crowd. The same thing with FDR. Now, Michelle, Tony and Phil have been studying this for years. What have you read? What's given you your insights into this quality of Lincoln? Because I think a lot of our listeners are trying to sort through these arguments, and we're seeing a lot of this, by the way, around the attacks on FDR coming from the same people who supported the fascists in Italy and Germany against him. So how, as a young person, did you tackle this question to get to the truth of who Lincoln really was?
Well, the first thing I did, this actually first came up from looking at Martin Luther King, because his famous I Have a Dream speech, I think it was, I believe it was that speech, he begins with the reference, he begins with the language that references Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and is in front of the Lincoln Memorial, in fact, and makes reference to that in the very beginning of that speech. So it really came up in the context of first thinking about what type of qualities of leadership are necessary to be able to move a population. And the closest thing that I could think of that I had a more of a sensual image of was the figure of Martin Luther King. So it began by looking at King and thinking about how King looked at the question of American history, because it is true that in the school system, you come through with an idea that there might be some good things about the United States, but overall it was just a continuation of what was going on in Europe. So looking at how somebody like Martin Luther King, who coming out of a generation that lived under Franklin Roosevelt, who had a clear sense of this historical continuity, I think, as is evidenced by the way that he took on his fight and the way that he saw the Constitution as actually very similar to the way that Lincoln was thinking about how you use the power of the Constitution to improve the moral quality of the society, actually. Coming at it from that standpoint was the entry. But then there's another question that comes up is how actually do you do a historical investigation? And I find that the best source is to go to the writings of Lincoln himself, the speeches that he gave, and the people that were around him. And it's interesting. I think that Lincoln is the most written about person. I think there's more biographies of Lincoln than anybody else in the world. So you have this huge mountain of information in front of you. But the real question is how do you find your way through that and get a really coherent picture that makes sense, that historically makes sense. And I think the way you do it is by really looking at the people he was collaborating with, look at the things that he said, the things that they said. I think one of the other aspects of this, in terms of understanding his economic policies, which is very rarely discussed in many of these books. It's very hard to find his economic views. But somebody like Henry Carey, who Lincoln had spent a lot of time studying, and this was one of the advisors to Lincoln, and look at the way that the type of dialogue that they're having, the things that they found were necessary to write, and I think it just draws you in. You just start doing that, and it just draws you in. The whole world.
Right. Now, you mentioned Carey as a very important figure. I'd like to get something from Tony on this because, Tony, I think you still have an unpublished manuscript which looks at the history, the economic history of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
What was it that, you mentioned earlier free trade, the fight for protectionism, but one of the things that I heard President Obama in his talk at Ford Theater brought up this thing. He said, well, in addition to his fight to save the Union, President Lincoln also started the Transcontinental Railroad,
yes.
as though those were separate.
Right.
How do you pull this together? Again, to go back to this question of the relationship between the idea of the nation from the founding fathers and the connection to scientific and technological progress.
Again, I think if you start with Franklin, and in that regard reference this man Leibniz in Germany, the two of them had this notion of happiness, which was, in Franklin's case, to get involved in almost every possible project, starting with the highest science on the planet, the science of electricity and related matters of the atmosphere and so forth, approaching it from the standpoint of giving power to mankind, absolute power, tremendous power. Often we are taught, especially after during the 60s and later, that power belongs to corrupt people, belongs to the devil. And the American idea of Franklin and earlier of Leibniz, and in their personal life is shown by all their projects, is that happiness is to apply this genius, this excitement for science and for improvement to statecraft and to spreading the idea to other people that we could set in motion a society with their own government, the government actually controlled by the population, and that society and that government would have as its purpose ennobling each person in the country. The way Lincoln expressed this in that speech that I mentioned, the question was, could the people have their own government that was for their benefit and improvement rather than be ruled arbitrarily by the powerful? Lincoln said in that speech to Congress, "It may be affirmed without extravagance that the free institutions we enjoy have developed the powers and improved the condition of our whole people beyond any example in the world. There are many single regiments in the army whose members, one and another, possess full practical knowledge of all the arts, sciences, professions, and whatever else useful or elegant is known in the world. There's scarcely one from which there could not be selected a president, a cabinet, a congress, and perhaps a court, abundantly competent to administer the government itself. The government which has conferred such benefits should not be broken up." What's the other idea, the enemy idea? I think people have to search their hearts now and look at countries like Afghanistan, India, China, South America, and say, if those people are to be permitted to have a future, then we know, they know, that it will have to be with steel mills, with nuclear power plants, with absolutely powerful ways to shape and improve nature. The enemy, the British Empire, the Confederacy, the slavery system, says absolutely not. That is the green idea. The green idea says we are stopping the conquest of nature by mankind. If you do that, then you're saying to the poor and the potential citizens of the world, you are not citizens. You are fit to be exterminated. Those are the two sides in the world.
And I think this is one of the most profound issues here that gets at the heart of the problem. And Phil, I'd like you to just extend that a little further, this question of the British Empire then and now, because, of course, one of the other, I would say, tragedies of our present time is that I saw very little coverage in the U.S. media of the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Very little. And instead, there was a lot of coverage of Charles Darwin's birthday, which I believe was his 200th also.
Mm-hmm.
So, Phil, when we're looking at this, the British Empire then and now, what are the parallels?
Well, I think the strongest parallel that you can get, I mean, if you take Darwin or you take the whole question of artificial intelligence, the Bertrand Russell outlook, that in a sense there is no such thing as human creativity. I mean, what Michelle's referring to, what Tony's referring to, is that, you know, Lincoln viewed the economy as the basis for developing the creative powers through the use of the creative powers of the individual human being, and having a nation which can then act on those creative discoveries. Without that, in a sense, you know, I think in a profound sense, the nation is the caretaker of the souls of its citizens, and it carries the discoveries, the actions, the contributions of the individual into the future as the development of the nation. But this means a certain idea of the creative powers of the human individual is what a society and wealth in an economy is all about. Now, what's the British or Venetian outlook, Sarpi's outlook? You know, if you look at the Occam that Sarpi bases himself on, there is no such thing as the creative powers of the human mind. There's nothing but sense experience and the reactions to those sense experiences. And this is the basis of Adam Smith. It's the basis of the free market. Human beings have only emotional reactions, pleasure and pain, or actually sensory reactions, not even emotional. And somehow, in the mix of those animal-like responses, we come up with that nature puts a price on a commodity. Whereas the American system says that it's the development of the creative powers and discoveries that allows society, as Tony was mentioning, to use the powers of mankind to also access the powers of nature. So what was Lincoln up against? What was slavery? There were people, much of the human species could not think, could not develop, and should not develop. They should simply be at the behest of some slightly more powerful form of animal called the oligarchy. Or you might say these are the alpha males that come out of historic development. So this is so slavery, the spread of slavery, the spread of drug usage, the opium usage against the Chinese population, the same thing we see today in Afghanistan, in South America, and so on. This is what Lincoln was fighting. This is what he knew to be wrong, as we've seen from some of the quotes. But I think one of the most interesting ways to look at it, and I think one thing that would be both a little bit of use of the humor and the irony of Lincoln, is that one of the problems we have is precisely the idea that globalization, free market, free trade is nature's way of telling you what to do, is nature's control over the human individual. Now, the reality of what Lincoln understood, and he makes jokes about this. For example, Lincoln's in 1837 has an address to the Illinois legislature, and he says, what is capitalism? These capitalists generally act harmoniously and in concert to fleece the people. Or in another, in 1861, 24 years later, a few men own capital, and that few avoid labor themselves. So he had an ironic, even humorous view of these things, but I think one of the important things is the idea that the choice is between some idea of socialism and capitalism is completely foreign. An American system is a different idea. The whole sense of political economy is a British conception. Ricardo Smith, and I would in his message to Congress, December 3rd, 1861, 6 months after the one that he says, labor is prior to and independent of capital. Capital is only the fruit of labor and could never have existed if labor had not first existed. Labor is the superior of capital and deserves much higher the higher consideration. Capital has its rights, which are worthy of protection as any other rights. But then he also sees labor as the development of labor power. There is no permanent class of hired laborers among us. 25 years ago, I was a hired laborer. The hired laborer of yesterday labors on his own account today and will hire others to labor for him tomorrow. So what could be more different than the sense of progress and development versus the idea in the celebrated Darwin that we are nothing but complicated animals?
You're listening to the LaRouche Show. This has been so far a quite provocative discussion of the real Abraham Lincoln. I would encourage people to go to the LaRouchePact.com website and look at the February 11th webcast delivered by Lyndon LaRouche. Again, this is the quality of leadership you'll see from the way LaRouche addresses our contemporary problems that is characteristic of what we've been discussing, and a continuity of leadership that from that of Lincoln, Franklin, Roosevelt, and to the present, what's been lacking, painfully lacking over the last 20 years. We have about 10 minutes left, so I'd like to get one last contribution from each of you. Michelle, let me start with you. If you had a couple minutes with President Obama, what would you tell him was what he needs to know about Lincoln?
Well, there was the first thing I mentioned at the beginning of the program was that in the time of a crisis with the type of danger that we're facing right now, the only thing that you can have most trust in is what you actually know. And taking the case of Lincoln, there were certain core principles of social organization, principles, economic principles, moral principles that he saw as uncompromisable. And no matter how much pressure he was going to get in any direction, that those were the principles he was going to fight for, even if it cost him his life, which in fact it did. So in the type of dangerous period we have right now, what's most important is that. That's what's most real, is the effect that your actions are going to have over a longer period of time, as opposed to making any short-term decisions for the sake of the moment. So I would say that's the first thing. But then the other thing I would want him to know is that Lincoln really did have a very scientific view of the question of economics. He had a scientific view of everything. That he would, that's just the way he thought. But particularly the question of economics, because of the nature of the crisis that we're facing right now, and to be bold enough to really introduce some new ideas, like, for instance, Lincoln he created a currency, a national currency, when we didn't have one. So an entire reorganization as a type of revolutionary action is the type of thing that you would need to have that type of courage to really follow through on that idea, despite all the popular opinion and nagging pressure that comes in opposition to it.
So Michelle, you think if Lincoln were around today, he would not be advocating sticking windmills on top of skyscrapers in New York City?
I don't think so.
Yeah. Now, Tony, how do we get this sense of real economics? I know this is what Lyndon LaRouche is doing. The LaRouche Pack TV, which is now a feature on the LaRouche Pack website, on a daily basis is putting up 3, 4, 5 minute spots that get at some of the real history that's going on. You have done some very creative, independent historical research. How do we get this out to the public? What's your thought on that?
Well, one thing is you might want to read the book that Lincoln read before he became president. It was published in 1858 and 59. It was called The Principles of Social Science, 3 volumes, by Henry C. Carey in Philadelphia. And then Carey and his friends got Lincoln nominated at the 1860 convention. What I'd like to do here, just very quickly, is to let out a kind of a family secret about why we don't know this about Lincoln. And you can trace this very simply. During the American Civil War, the British landed troops in Canada and in Mexico. They had their excuses for each one. Mexico didn't pay their debts, and Canada, they didn't like our treatment of the Trent affair. The British and the Austrians and the French put a dictator on the throne of Mexico, Maximilian. And they didn't get their confederacy to overthrow our country in the end. But so what happened at the end of the war, that after John Wilkes Booth had gone to Canada, consulted with those British military people up there, and then came back and killed Lincoln. Nevertheless, our system, this protective tariff system, this strong government nationalism, got exported to Germany, to Russia, to Japan, and elsewhere. The British and these European feudalists in Austria concocted a whole scheme of economic propaganda, which they called the Austrian School of Economics. Mm-hmm. And it designated, it was the Emperor of Austria and the British Foreign Office together. And they said that Abraham Lincoln and his follower, Bismarck of Germany, who had adopted Lincoln's economics, were the bogeymen of the universe. They were communists. They called them everything. In the period of Franklin Roosevelt, this dogma, through the person of Friedrich Hayek and others, was brought back to attack Franklin Roosevelt, the same exact same institutions, through Britain, where Hayek went, from Austria. And at the end of the war, they set up a group called the Mont Pelerin Society. This group is spreading an attack both against Lincoln directly and against Franklin Roosevelt. And this is the source from the British oligarchy, from these old undead Venetians and Habsburg types that have never agreed that we should have modern times, let alone the United States of America. This is the dirty little family secret of all this propaganda against Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, which is now coming up when we're trying to decide whether we're going to save the country by going back to FDR economics.
And coordinating it at the center is Rupert Murdoch, an Anglo-Dutch agent through the Wall Street Journal, and his paid little prostitute, Amity Schley.
Yes, and she's controlled by the Mont Pelerin Society.
Exactly.
That's where it comes
Phil,
from.
Phil, we have just about 2 minutes for your final thoughts.
Well, I think to 2 minutes, I hope. You know, we face an existential crisis, as Lyndon LaRouche has said as recently as this morning. We face an existential crisis. This nation may not survive, nor may civilization. It parallels what, and Lynn forecast this most decisively over this period of 40 years, but on July 25th of 2007, the system that we live in is dead. We need to move to something totally different. We have a history of it in the American system. Lincoln forecast the same crisis, a similar crisis at the time. I think if I would tell Obama, I would say, first of all, recognize what you know and act on it. Secondly, I would say that recognize something else in character, in the way he thinks, in what he represents in American history. The person closest to Lincoln today, or who represents Lincoln and with added development of knowledge and his own scientific powers, Lyndon LaRouche is the person who does today represent what Lincoln did when he came to the presidency in 1861.
Phil, I think
I think is the best lesson.
I think we're going to have to stop at that. That is the important lesson, because we know that there is a dialogue going on between Lyndon LaRouche and people around President Obama, and that the issue has been settled. LaRouche's policies work. The policies of Wall Street, of London, will not work and will destroy the country. And that's the kind of message that Abe Lincoln would deliver. I'd like to thank the three of you today. This has been a very excellent discussion. The LaRouche Show is archived, so those of you who listen to this live can call its attention to call your friends' attention to it, get them to listen to it. It's on LaRouchePub.com under the LaRouche Show. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Saturday afternoon at 3 Eastern with the next edition of the LaRouche Show.
Thanks.